You're listening to the Tilehurst End Podcast by Reading fans for Reading fans.
Hello and welcome to part three of the Tilehurst End Podcast Decade in Review series as we end the 2010s by looking back at the last 10 years at Reading Football Club. We have reached what is likely to be the most depressing period to talk about. That is the last 2.5 seasons since that playoff final defeat. And to go through all of that with me is a regular host of the podcast, Mark Mayo. Mark, how's it going?
Hello, Ollie. How's it going, mate?
Yeah, very well. It seemed a little bit odd for me sitting this side of the table, in a sense. Me hosting and you guesting.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking that when we had our little break before we started speaking then and you began the intro, I was thinking, what am I going to say? No, hang on. I get the relaxing job today of sitting back and letting you control the procedure.
Unknown territory. The previous episode, of course, ended with me and Sim, as Reading had been just 2 penalty kicks away from promotion. And, of course, whilst that playoff final defeat to Swansea in 2011 had been followed by a fantastic run to the Championship after the following season, 2017-18, following that Wembley defeat to Huddersfield, was quite the opposite. I mean, there was certainly quite a lot of ambition shown by Reading the following summer, as their new owners, the Chinese brother and sister, Dai Yong and Dai Zhuli, they'd been announced on the same night, actually, as Reading had beaten Fulham in the playoff semi-final back in May. And they certainly showed a sort of bit of intent that summer. They broke Reading's transfer record for Sonny Aluko, $7.5 million reported. It might be a little bit less than that, sort of with a few add-ons. But as well as that, you know, we saw John W. Bodvarsson come in, Vita Minone, Mo Barrow, Leandro Bakuna, Dave Edwards, quite a long list of Reading players, and none of them free either. You know, we'll talk about the following summer a little bit later, where quite a lot of the signings were free. But all of these players came in for sort of £1.5 million, £2 million. So really, it was sort of the most money that Reading had ever spent in one summer. Ron Gourlay as well, he came in as the CEO. You know, I'm sure we'll talk a lot about his ill-fated tenure in this episode, but he's sort of come in, obviously, formerly of Chelsea, of United as well. And what was your feeling towards sort of that money spent in that summer, Mark? You know, it was clearly sort of a statement of intent from the new owners.
It was, and especially with the Aluko, that was a bit of a saga, really, wasn't it? Because we didn't sign him until the 29th of August. We had obviously been linked with him for ages, and there was wranglings with him. I think he was in the last year of his contract with Fulham as well. So that was a bit drawn out. But ultimately, I still remember looking back at the time and thinking each of these signings, isolated at the time, were good signings. If you think about Dave Edwards was potentially that box-to-box, late-arriving midfielder that we didn't really have. Sonny Aluko had played in a Fulham team that was of the same sort of tactical setup that we wanted to be, pass and move and a bit more patient and a bit of energy going into the box. Mo Barrow was that pacey winger that with players like Roy Burns, you knew that they weren't going to last forever, so you needed a replacement there. Even John Danny Bodvarsson, you could see the sort of logic, knowing that Jan Kermigan, maybe they were going to be similar strikers, with Jan Kermigan obviously being injured for so long and Vito Minone, a Premier League goalkeeper. That's all well and good in isolation, but when you bring these players together, I think we quickly realised that as a unit, and this is, you know, we can compare to what happened in 2011-12 after that playoff defeat, as a unit, these players just didn't match up, really.
Indeed, I think you could potentially say that sort of those, I think certainly some of those signings coming in were essentially tried to be replacements for, you know, 3 key players that had been key to that side the season before. I mean, obviously we lost Shane Long in 2011 and sort of, you know, struggled to replace him to begin with, and obviously Lafondre came in and we went on that fantastic run in the second half of that season. But the departures of Ali Alhabsi and Danny Williams, who both left that summer, really hit Reading hard, as did Jan Kermigan. He was injured for much of the next campaign. Obviously, his goals were vital the previous season. Alhabsi made a number of key saves, and I think Danny Williams, even though he wasn't perhaps, you know, massively influential throughout the entire season, certainly in that playoff final, you saw just how important he can be to Reading. And really, Reading sort of, you know, failed to replace all 3 of those. I mean, Minone was supposedly Alhabsi's replacement, but again, you know, yes, he's got Premier League pedigree, but certainly he wasn't making those saves Alhabsi was making. Bodvarsson, he got a few goals, but certainly couldn't match Kermit's level. And probably, you know, you were hoping that a combination of Bakuna and Edwards was trying to replace Danny Williams. But again, not really that sort of box-to-box style that we could sort of hope for from Danny Williams. And Reading started the next season, in really poor form. We obviously had that 2-0 defeat to QPR on the opening day, where I think Thiago Laura got sent off. We then did win two of our next four games against Aston Villa and Birmingham City. But again, after that, Reading really struggled. We lost 1-0 to Bristol City at home. We drew with Brentford and Hull, lost to Millwall, lost to Norwich. And really, Mark, you know, was it the departures or sort of the absence of those three players, Ohabsi, Williams and Kermigan? How much were Reading feeling that?
I think at this stage it was quite clear that we were losing the players that were able to kind of get us over the line in victories. We obviously won a lot of those playoff games quite narrowly. And if you look at the sort of points we were dropping, that Fulham home game was quite famous, the first home game of the season, 1-0 up, Fulham down to 10 men for almost the entire 90 minutes. And Lucas Pearson pops up with an 82nd minute winner. That was the sort of game we had to have won. Then even the Aston Villa game that we won 2 days later, we were 2-0 up and cruising. And then Aston Villa scored in the 87th minute, and suddenly one of the worst teams that came to the Medeski Stadium all season, they were on the verge of getting a point in the last couple of minutes until I think they missed a free kick. So we lost the players, you know, obviously Ohabsi was able to make the sort of saves that he was able to make, and Danny Williams was a brilliant sort of driving force, bringing the ball out of defence and into more safe areas. And you know, it's difficult when you have players like Leandro Bacuna and Dave Edwards, players who I think ultimately we realised that these, you know, Williams and Ohabsi, etc., were a team that probably played above the sum of their parts to get to the playoff final, relied on a brilliant sort of team spirit to get there as well. And we replaced them with players that ultimately haven't really ever shown in their careers to be part of teams with brilliant team spirit, and just weren't as good, I think, fundamentally as well, even if they had the sort of pedigree. And quickly to sort of go back to 11-12 and what we did after that, there was the continuity in the owners, in the running of the club, that we lost with the 17-18 with Gourlay coming in the July. But also we replaced those players with either, you know, just generally very good players, such as Kasper Schwartz came in, generally a very good player to replace Matt Mills, and players who were hungry and had something to prove. Lafondre, you could probably put Legitwood in that as well. And, you know, Jason Roberts came in January, and the rest is history. But for that summer, there was a much greater sense of continuity and still being on the same path. Whereas in 17-18... we really kind of changed that path, and you can see in the early results there was no sense of consistency. You know, we weren't able to score many goals because obviously Jan Kermigant was injured. And you look at, I think by October, when we're losing 2-0 at home to Middlesbrough, we weren't really that optimistic. We were already about 20th in the league, and we're stuck in the spiral then of thinking, well, we're not going to be able to produce a massive turnaround like we did in 11-12, when of course we did actually start quite poorly as well.
I think, you know, some of those players as well, you have to look towards the playing style as well, because it was clear that maybe some of those, you know, the likes of Bakuna and Barry didn't quite fit the sort of the stand possession based formula. Obviously Barry's a pacey winger that can be good at points, but when you're trying to pass the ball around and not sort of set wingers free, it's not always the best environment for Mo Barry to thrive in. And I think that was the thing as well, because teams had sort of begun to suss out Yapstam, and I think that was part of the reason why we did so well in this first season. Even if the XG said that we shouldn't have been as hard as we were, you know, teams didn't really know how to deal with it. You know, I mean, especially at home, obviously away from home, we struggled and sort of got beat 7-1 by Norwich and 5-0 by Fulham. But certainly at home, I think we lost just two games at home all season in 16-17. But then the following year, teams had begun to suss it out, and Stam's problem then was that he just had no plan B. He was very, very stubborn in his tactics. You know, didn't really want to change away from that sort of 4-3-3 formation to try and get Reading, you know, results. And I think we had that sort of mini revival, sort of November, December time, where I think we went on a 5-match unbeaten run. We beat Barnsley 3-0 and Sunderland 3-1. And then it was that 2-2 Cardiff game at home, which for me was a massive turning point in that season. I think obviously Reading 2-0 up, I think, at half time. And then Cardiff scored twice in the second half to take that win away from Reading. I think obviously if we'd won that game, it would have been three wins in a row. And we sort of, you know, might have been sort of, you know, about 12, 13th in the table. And that's certainly not that bad at all. As you sort of head towards the halfway mark, and you can sort of hope that you can make that run in the second half of the season. But that game that Reading then drew with Cardiff, that just started a quite frankly miserable run for Reading, and ultimately, you know, spelled the end for Yap Stam. Just one win in 18 league games after that 2-2 draw with Cardiff, and that was the 3-1 win away to Burton Albion at the end of January. It did, of course, lead to Yap Stam's eventual sacking in the March international break. So, as I say, one win in 18 games. What was your general feeling towards that choice, Mark?
I think at the time, and I sort of agree with myself in hindsight, that it came too late. If we if Reading make that decision at the start of January, I think there's it makes sense, because, as you say, the problem was that there was no plan B. He wasn't utilising the players correctly, and you can say that they weren't the right players for his system, but there were many, many managers across the game that ply their trade on having no say whatsoever in the transfers, and they get given the players, they make the best of what they've got. Reading went into January. Yes, we had a little bit of an uprise in November and sort of a late October, early December, but as you say, that Burton game, which I think that was a massive landmark game in Reading's history as a club. And we lost to Burton terribly. Then we lost to Birmingham at home terribly. And I remember at the time thinking, God, it's really boring being a Reading fan at the moment. And we were pretty boring in the playoff final season, but we got wins. And you end up being in the situation going into January thinking, what are we actually keeping the manager for? Are we keeping him as a favour, as a token for our gratitude as to what he did in the playoff final season? Are we keeping him because we genuinely believe that he's going to turn things around? It feels to me like we did it for the former reason, that we were doing it saying, well, he did well last year and we keep the faith and something's got to happen. But, you know, you can say the stats disagreed with that. You can obviously say the results disagreed with that. And by the time we did make the plunge, it just felt like we had invested a lot in a man who, firstly, didn't really seem to appreciate that we'd invested time in him. And secondly, in a system that, you know, that all of the evidence suggested had been failing for a number of weeks.
I mean, the fan base was massively split at the time. And I think, you know, those who were very much in favour of Sam, I think one argument you can make is that he certainly gave Reading the identity. Obviously, you know, as you say, he had a very, very clear playing style, didn't you know, sort of sway away from that. And I think some fans enjoyed that in a sense that, you know, you could define, you know, what Reading was, in a sense that we were becoming, you know, that side who did play possession football. So as you say, it wasn't getting results, but it certainly gave Reading that identity, and you could say that was ours. But at the same time, you know, those results, and I think even Paul Clement, who we'll come on to talk about in just a minute, even he didn't go on a run that bad, and it was one win in 18 games. Like, you look back at it now and you think that, you know, we've gone on runs of since, you know, sort of four defeats in a row or whatever, and it still wasn't that bad. And I don't think he's almost quite taken the enormity of it at the time, that it really was just absolutely terrible to watch, and the fan base had turned toxic at that point. As I say, there was this massive split about people who wanted Stam in and sort of deserved time after getting Reading to that playoff final the year before. And as I say, you can't, I don't think you can take away from that, because the transformation that Stam, you know, carried out in that first season and getting Reading, you know, who had finished 17th the season before, to, you know, to finish third and to get them two penalty kicks away from the Premier League can't be understated. But then again, you know, to that following season, as I say, that the football just became, you know, just very, very boring to watch. I mean, the players, you know, still seem to you know, sort of stand by Stam. I think, you know, during Stam's time and even since he's left, a lot of players have sort of come out and said, I think Liam Moore's come out and said it, Chris Gunter, I think, has said it as well, that Stam was one of the best coaches, or the best coach, that they've ever worked under. You know, which seems bizarre. And I think, you know, we'll talk about Jose Gomez as well in a minute, that potentially one of the reasons why he left was that he lost the dressing room. And that certainly wasn't, it didn't seem to be the case with Stam, but they were certainly still playing for him. But it was just the fact that, you know, teams had sussed out his style. There was no plan B. And I think certainly from my point of view, I'd agree with you in the sense that decision came later than it should have done.
I think with the when you say that he's the best coach they've ever worked under, part of me has always felt that what they actually mean is the most famous coach they've ever worked
with. Potentially,
under.
Yeah.
Because there is that sort of authority that that someone like Yap Stam has, that someone like Paul Clement just frankly doesn't. And, that, you know, that's in his playing career, and that's in his in his demeanour. And also to add on to the point about the fan base, that I think this applies for the Gomez thing as well, is that fans generally, particularly fans that are more active online, are absolutely desperate to buy into something, to sort of have a club identity and to have a, you know, have that reflect upon themselves, whether it's on Twitter or just on themselves in the stands or whatever. And what they had with the Stam era was that kind of Dutch revolution thing, yeah, with Brian Teverden as well. A lot of fans really like based themselves around that, were really buying into it. And they found it hard to give up because it's very difficult to admit that something that you've invested a lot of time in is wrong or failing. And it happened with Gomez as well, because a lot of fans, you know, they'd have the Portuguese flags after their Twitter handle or something like that. And when you've invested that time, it makes you look a little bit silly when you then have to say, we have to sack this man. So I think that plays a part into it as well.
Because we had that, we had Orange Day on the last day, that's sort of 16, 17 away to birth. And, you know, and Stanley's gone less than 12 months later. Again, the same with Gomez, as we'll talk about Portugal Day in May. And he's gone, you know, 6 months later. But yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Paul Clement came in to replace Stan, as we say. You know, Stan, someone who had a fantastic playing career. Paul Clement, someone who I think retired in his early 20s and, you know, very much made his career as a number two, sort of following Carlo Ancelotti around, you know, had had his time, I think, at Derby and at Swansea as well. But it was really sort of the first time we began to see the influence of Ron Gourlay, you know, taking an effect. Obviously, he'd known Paul Clement from his time at Chelsea. Was it just a case of someone different coming into Stam, someone different to Stam, sorry, coming in to sort of change things up, Mark? Because Reading did stumble over the line to survival. We just about got them. We won that game 1-0 against QPR in his first game, but then we only won against Preston 1-0 again after that. And other than that, the rest of that season wasn't, you know, overly, you know, exciting. I think we, you know, we lost away to Sheffield Wednesday. We had that terrible 4-0 defeat at home to Ipswich Town in the final home game of the season, which was just terrible. I mean, I think even all of the Stand games, I think even that Ipswich game was worse than all of those, that 4-0 at home. And I think it won our worst moment of 2018 in the podcast awards that year as well. I mean, was it just a case of just someone different, Mark, or did Clement really have a part to play in Reading getting over the line that season?
It's funny, I'm looking at the results now, and I see I've always, you know, had in my mind that we went on a pretty good run when Clement came in, and you can actually see when you look at the results, they're frankly rubbish. You know, we won those two games at QPR and Preston, but we got spanked at Villa, spanked at Sheffield Wednesday, spanked against Ipswich. We had three players sent off in his first six games, and I think we were very, very lucky that season that the rest of the championship in the relegation battle was very, very poor. And we drew, yeah. I think by the time we came to draw against Cardiff on the last day of the season, we were everything but mathematically safe. And we stayed up with a record of less than a point a game. We conceded 70 goals over the season, you know, half of which were at home. And yeah, I think that with Clement, his appointment, it was a case of he's someone else. He's going to have a bit of a different playing style. I remember a lot of the fans at that QPR game were saying, yes, we don't have to pass it around at the back anymore. But Clement, you know, as will bear fruit in his first, you know, you can also say his first attempt at a full season, that first, you know, seven games that he came in charge, and he didn't really know, he had a vague idea of what how he wanted to play, but he kept changing it and he didn't know exactly what sort of manager he was. So yes, he was someone different from Stam, but his own identity, still to this day, I don't know what it is.
I think you have to thank Paul Clement to an extent, because I do think without that 1-0 with QPR in his first game, you know, we might well not have survived. And, you know, and I don't think Yapstam would have got that win. So in a sense, you have to thank Paul Clement for that. But 44 points Reading finished on that season, which usually is a points tally that will, you know, leave you in very, very grave danger of going down, or usually might even send you down. So I think Reading were quite lucky that season, and indeed the following season as well, that we'll talk about now, that our points tally really in sort of any other championship season or most other championship seasons would have, you know, sent us down in a sense. But we then had that summer, of course, Paul Clement's first summer in charge. And again, it was just defined by this poor recruitment. I think, you know, we had the sort of early sort of beginning of the summer where Andy Yeardon came in on the free. And really, he's the only sort of signing you can say from that summer that was a true success. Obviously, I think he won our player of the season vote last season and is proving, you know, I think for me, Yeardon is definitely one of the best fullbacks in the championship. And to get him on a free transfer is probably a fantastic bit of business. But really, the only one you can say that about, because in came David Myler, who again, I think obviously he had his off the field problems and whatnot and injuries, but again that didn't quite work out. John O'Shea, obviously a legend of the game, but again 37 years old, he's not going to add an awful lot to your side. Sam Walker as well came in on the frame, was one of four goalkeepers we used that season. In terms of strikers, Mark McNulty and Sam Baldock sort of came in and added firepower, but again not really getting the goals. I think McNulty got just one or two all season before being shipped that one out in January. Sam Baldock couldn't quite get going, and Josh Sims and Saeed Ezatalahi came in on loan. And really, Mark, considering the awful season we'd had before, these weren't really the signings you sort of wanted to make going into the new campaign.
Well, yeah, once again, we had a situation. I suppose this is probably Gourlay's problem, isn't it? That he makes signings that on their own individual basis sounds like a good idea, but when put into a team, it's not. Because as you say, we got him early. We had to get him early in the window. A lot of teams thought he was a good player, and he's proved to be just that. But David Myler, as the tough tackling, ball winning midfielder, we thought was a great signing. That's not what he proved to be. John O'Shea, if we'd have signed him 4 years earlier, great signing, but he'd just been relegated from the Championship with Sunderland. None of us expected him to really play a major part in the actual defence, and therefore he was pretty much a coach, and that's what he is now. So that was a non-event, really. Sam Walker coming in, okay, he's a backup goalkeeper. Not gonna make any difference over the course of the season. McNulty and Baldock were the two ones that I suppose we really pitched our tent around. And the thing is that McNulty wasn't anything like as prolific as a Lafondre or that sort of striker that we've signed from the lower leagues. He played the Championship before and hadn't done particularly well. So on the hope that here is a player who's going to knuckle down and really, prove that he is better player than he was in previous years, it just didn't work out. And those things, for me, the McNulty thing, I'm not too annoyed about, because it was a reasonably cheap attempt at doing what Reading have done well in the past. The problem was, we signed Sam Baldock, and I'm not sure he really got that good a chance under Clement. And when you have these players come in, we sold pitifully few players compared to how many we needed to sell. And when you get into this situation with a big squad, a lot of players who don't really know their role in it, you are just kind of thinking, well, you need a manager who is going to really pick a system and go with it and settle down and say, this is how we play football. Paul Clement just wasn't that man.
I think that's the problem as well. I think, we signed all of these players that summer, but really the only ones that went out, George Evans went out to Derby, and I think Jan Kermigan retired or whatever. But other than that, I think Jerry van den Bergen might go on as well. No one really left, and you're left with this bloated squad that, you can only start 11 players each week, and certain players like Mark McNulty or David Myler or whatever aren't going to get a fair crack at the whip. And whether that was a problem within the squad, that there was discontent or whatever, Reading started the season in absolutely terrible form. We lost the first three games of the season. Of course, we actually topped the Championship, of course, for about 8 minutes on that Friday night against Derby, Frank Lampard's Derby. And of course, before losing 2-1 late on to a late Tom Lawrence goal. As I say, we lost the first three games. No win that season until the seventh game away from home against Preston. And 9 points from our first 12 games signalled our worst start to a league season post-war. So that shows just how bad Paul Clement was. It did start to sort of pick up a little bit. Obviously, we got that win. I think it was 3-0 against Hull. I think it ended up being our biggest win of the entire season.
And that again, whole team are awful, by the way, as well.
And obviously we get into November, and the first sort of big key moment of that season, Ron Gourlay leaves, and sort of growing resentment had been sort of coming against Ron Gourlay. We talked about his poor record in the transfer market. He handed out massive contracts to players that perhaps didn't necessarily deserve them. And we talk a lot about the impact that Ron Gourlay had on his football club and sort of the mess that he left it in, as I say, with the finances and whatnot. What's your feeling towards Ron Gourlay, Mark? I think, obviously, we talk about him as someone who's obviously clearly used to sort of much bigger clubs, likes of Chelsea, likes of United. Was it just a case of that Reading wasn't the right fit for him?
Yeah, I think the thing is with Gourlay is that he had a mantra of doing business which involved signing players who, in theory, fit the team, and putting players on long contracts and generally trying to bring quality in rather than growing quality inside the club. He would try and bring in players who are already fit, ready-made for an idea of, a tough tackle midfielder, David Myler, ready, fit, go, everything works that way. Sadly, I think that works on FIFA. I don't think it works in real life because there are obviously so many facets of recruitment that we as humble fans don't really understand. But when it comes to building a dressing room, his signings were completely useless in that respect. When it came to stretching a budget, you could kind of see what he's going at. Obviously, in that second summer we've just spoken about, there's a lot of free signings. And in theory, signing someone like Sam Baldock does work. But he was probably the man responsible for bringing Paul Clement in. And Paul Clement just couldn't make a team out of these players. And what we had with the players who, we couldn't sell on, we couldn't shift players, that was because of Wagnoli, because he put them on too big contracts, because their wages were perhaps too generous to move them out, and because as the nature of the players, we'd signed Bakuna from Villa, who I think was still in the Premier League at the time, or maybe just been relegated, and therefore he was on that sort of wage, and we probably matched it or got close to matching it. None of these players had any resale value, and the ones who did, we obviously didn't fancy selling or weren't, someone like John Swift wasn't worth selling at that point because we knew it was going to be better than what he was. So the thing with Gourlay is that there were those sort of mistakes. There were also the mistakes you can, anecdotally, I'm sure people in the know can say about the culture of the club. There was rumours a lot of people leaving who have been there for many years. And we as a club and the owners in particular entrusted him to build a long-term, you'd hope, vision for the club and to form a plan. It felt like that plan kind of was what he felt like in the morning, and it felt like that sort of plan wasn't a long-term plan, but simply one to kind of nudge the team up as quickly as possible. And in the end, what we were left with was a situation where our squad had massively depreciated in value. We didn't have the results on the pitch to show it. We weren't actually, one of the big problems as well, and we found that after sacking Gomez, is that we weren't actually capable of going and hiring a manager who was going to take the team forward significantly, because the good managers who have maybe just left the Premier League or up and coming in the Championship, they didn't want to come to Reading anymore because there was no X or Y is brilliant about Reading at the moment. And I think those sort of things are on Gourlay's legacy, because we just ended up as a club almost on every aspect on a downturn he's only left about less than 18 months, and yet he managed to sort of shake things almost entirely badly.
I mean, well, that leads us quite nicely on to the next little bit, because it did lead, obviously Nigel Howe came in to replace Ron Gourlay. I think within 24 hours of Nigel Howe being confirmed as a new CEO, Paul Clement was sacked, he was gone. And really, I think Reading were 21st in the table, but Clement ended up with the worst win percentage, 23.3% of any manager in the modern era of Reading's history. And I think the general feeling, we spoke about the split of the fan base when Yapstan was sacked, and I think if one thing you can say about Clement is certainly unite the fan base and sort of hating him, really. And I think he'll probably be one of the most unpopular Reading managers in recent times, Paul Clement. And again, I feel sorry for Clement to a certain extent, because I certainly don't think he was the problem at Reading at that time. We've spoken about Gourlay and the mess that he left and sort of how Stan had got Reading playing this certain way and the recruitment and whatnot. And I certainly don't think Paul Clement was the problem in that regard. He might have made it a little bit worse, but he wasn't the root of the problem. But at the same time, he certainly wasn't the solution. I don't think, we've spoken about him being, traditionally a number two. He's not had a job since. Whether he'll rock up at Everton now that Carlo Ancelotti is there, who knows? But I don't think he was the right man. Obviously, we've spoken about his link with Gourlay and whatnot. He didn't seem like the right man long term for Reading.
No, and that's the thing, isn't it? That when you employ a manager, you can either go down. There's almost only two routes at the moment for a Championship team. You can either go and get your Neil Warnock type, your Tony Pulis type, and say, almost like a Jose Mourinho type, actually, you're only going to be here for maybe 2-3 years, but you're going to get the job done. You're going to keep us safe, to maybe improve the value of the squad, and then you're going to leave, and we're going to be left with probably a coach who's going to have to change a lot once you have left. But in that time, you're going to be all right. Or you go with the sort of long-term younger manager, really invest in a plan, and settle for whatever happens short term, you hope long term will be better.
The problem is with Hall Clement is he doesn't fit into either of those two categories. He wasn't wily enough or experienced enough to be that sort of Warnock type, and he wasn't, frankly, as good a, you know, as good a man motivator or anything like that. But he also didn't have the vision to be a long-term manager, and he ended up being, I think, as he's found in all of his, all of the clubs he's gone to, being stuck in this kind of middle road as to what does he really stand for as a manager, what can he really achieve. And to be fair, I think when Jose Gomez came in, I'd actually say that he, in a way, he was probably a bit more of the short-term type. With he's a little bit more into that, that Warnock-esque mentality, in the sense, you know, obviously his playing style is completely different, but he is felt to me like a man who is going to ramp up things in the short term, give everyone a bit of a boost, and then by the time that boost has worn off, he kind of runs out of ideas and we have to move over again and force a bit of a culture change. But yeah, I think for Clement, he's just, I think that it's a very clear sign that since Reading he hasn't got back into management, and that's a pretty clear indication that he was never going to be a brilliant Championship manager.
Well, certainly wherever Gomez had been beforehand, he hadn't stayed for very long. Obviously, you know, we'll come on to him now. He was appointed on the same day as Reading lost to Middlesbrough just before Christmas. I think we were in the relegation zone by that point. But in comes Jose Gomez, this unknown Portuguese entity. As I say, managed in Spain, Greece, Hungary, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, so all over the place. And he finally achieved his dream of managing in England. It was very clear that Reading wanted a foreign coach. I think, you know, we saw the likes of Luis Castro and Vitor Pereira also linked to the job. I think Castro certainly turned it down. I think Pereira might well have turned down as well. But what was your feeling towards Gomez when he first came in, Marcus? As we say, you know, no one knew anything about him. First job in England, but he did certainly have a quite a big job on his hands to keep Reading safe.
Well, he fitted into a number of things that you pick out from a manager from day one. He's not a bad looking fella. He can talk well. He's obviously, you know, he's quite thoughtful, and all those things you're happy about, and you're going to take anything you can get when a new manager comes in. And really, we knew that there were a lot of problems about this squad, and I suppose my reservations kind of, I think everyone's kind of reservations stuck in those early weeks. The 0-0 draw at QPR was good. The most promising results, I think, that kind of get ignored as well are the 0-0 draws with Villa and Sheffield Wednesday, because those were two, you know, decent teams, and Reading finally showed a bit of defensive grit, a bit of ability to hold out a game and get a point and move on, which is very commendable. And with Gomez, I think ultimately no fan can sit there on the first day and say, oh yeah, Jose Gomez, perfect man for the job, absolutely everything we want, because we didn't know anything about him. And that was kind of, I think we remained for a number of weeks not knowing anything about him, and it wasn't until you can say sort of the Villa and Sheffield Wednesday games, and then the ensuing sort of Blackburn wins and Ipswich Town wins, that we actually started to get to know Jose Gomez, because before that he hadn't really shown, you know, the passion and everything like that which the club was dying for, really. And when he talked about the fan base as well, he always spoke very, very nicely about that and paid credit to the fans. And it was only in the sort of February, March sort of time that we actually got to see the man for who he was. And a lot of people like that.
Well, January was a key month for Reading. Certainly in the transfer market, as you say, we had that bloated squad. We sort of had to get players out before they came in. And, you know, we saw the likes of Pella Clement go out, Thiago Alori, Leandro Bacuna. All were sold. I think Rita Minone went out on loan. Mark McNulty went out on loan. David Myler went out on loan. I think Aluko went to Beijing Ren as well. So it was very clear that the first job at hand for Gomez and for Nigel Howe was to get that squad down and then bring the quality in. And, you know, boy, did we bring that quality in. You know, using that loan market, you know, absolutely brilliantly. In comes Ovi Ejaria, Lewis Baker, Nelson Oliveira, Emi Martinez and Matt Miazga all arrive. And again, Reading don't have the finances to afford the permanent signings. So as I say, they use the loan market absolutely brilliantly, bringing these five players in. And these five players really, you know, they each in their own sort of individual way played their part in Reading staying up. And I think you look at our Player of the Month awards for the second half of last season, and I think the shortlists for each award are dominated by these five loanees. I think you know, Martinez made some fantastic saves in Garvin, and you can see why, you know, he's at Arsenal and sort of deserves his chance playing in the Europa League with them. Ajari has obviously come back and done fantastically, and we know what he's all about. Lewis Baker we're certainly missing, I think, at the moment. Obviously, he's not getting the game time out in Germany. I think we'd certainly take him back in January if he was available. Nelson Oliveira, someone we were linked with for obviously a long period of time, and came in, and obviously he probably had maybe the least impact, I might say, but, you know, I think purely because he didn't play an awful lot because of injuries and whatnot. But when he did play, obviously he got that goal at Ipswich, got the goal against Blackburn as well. I think I remember, you know, a crucial 3 points there, and finally Matt Miazga as well. You know, he certainly bulked up that defence, I think, provided a solid partner for Liam Moore. I think Moore said he's one of the best players he's played alongside at centre back, and sort of replacing Thiago Alori. And really, Mark, I think the arrival of these five players were absolutely crucial to sort of Reading staying in the Championship.
Well, I think the key thing that you can say about those five players, as you have just kind of said, is that you can make a case for any one of them being the best of the five. You can say that, to be fair, I think Ajaria probably had the least impact, and yet this season he's obviously stayed on and been one of our best players. So Martinez, Premier League quality footballer, Nelson Oliveira, on his day, Premier League quality, Baker and Miazga likewise. And the fact that each one of them had their own little period of whether it was the entire time they were there or just a little spurt of 3-4 games, each one of them, you could probably point to a couple of fixtures and a couple of wins that they seriously contributed to. And that is without those players, you can make a pretty convincing argument that we wouldn't have stayed up. I think it was 7 points was the gap that we stayed up by in the end with a lot of goal difference. And without them, you maybe you keeping that to 2 points maximum, because they just provided that general quality, that spine of a team that can see out a 20-minute period that's a bit dodgy, that can hold on to the ball for the first 5 minutes and make sure we don't concede. And that's just not what we were doing before. We were giving away really sloppy goals. We were watching so many games pass us by, and I think in that era after the players arrived, there's the Sheffield United and Leeds games, obviously those two teams doing very well, that passed us by, and sorry, and the whole game as well to an extent that we actually led in. Other than that, we were in every single game, and we played a lot of good teams in that period. You know, we went to Norwich and got a really good point, went to Bristol City, got a good point. We held West Brom. We should have won that game. That pretty much confirmed our safety. These were really good teams we were facing. We were doing all right. And actually, I think this period, it's not, for me, it's not anything like as good as a period as it was under McDermott when he took over from Rodgers, and obviously the spell we went on from that, and what happened afterwards. But it was a genuinely very exciting time to be a Reading fan, because it did feel like we'd won something. We'd actually come out of a relegation battle very comfortably at the end. And that, you know, the way we did it, and obviously there were cracks shown there and those sort of appeared later on. But, you know, the way we did it actually was quite entertaining for the fans. And Gomez did his job. Those players did their job. And I think that there's not too much we can say to sort of argue against that, given the circumstances.
I think it was the nature of those wins as well. I mean, you look at the way that Reading won games in that period. You know, the 2-1 win over Blackburn when Nelson Oliveira scored, 86-minute winner. The 2-1 win away win at Ipswich, Mo Barrow, 90th-minute winner. 3-2 win against Wigan. We were 2-1 down with sort of, you know, seconds left. Mo Barrow scores, I think, in the 89th-minute, and then Yaki Mate scores in the 97th. And you look at the way that Reading won those games. And it was exciting. It was entertaining. It got fans, you know, off their seats. And you have to say part of that is, you know, thanks to Jose Gomez. You know, we spoke about earlier, you know, his sort of charismatic personality. He was very, very likable. You know, he fostered that good connection between the fans and the club. And as we say, you know, that was something that was massively missing in sort of the second half of Jaap Stam's reign and indeed all throughout Paul Clement's reign. And there was this massive apathy between the club and the fan base. And I don't think you can underestimate how well, you know, Gomez did to bring that back. You know, you saw certainly that Wigan game, the 3-2 win. Club 1871 really took off that game. I think that game has been a massive catalyst for sort of how well that section of support has done. And I think it was, you know, I don't think they'd mind me saying that it was sort of struggling before that game. You know, certainly in the first half of that season, you know, when results weren't going our way, it was, you know, quite hard to attract fans to go and sit over in that area. But that was a massive, you know, sort of advocate, if you like, that game to you know, for fans to go and sit over in that corner and to create, you know, a fantastic atmosphere. And obviously, we'll, you know, we'll come on in a minute to talk about how it ended for Jose Gomez, but the relationship that he had with supporters, certainly in the second half of last season, as I say, I don't think you can understate how massive it was that for that to happen, because, as I say, the apathy was so high in the first half of that season. And for us to sort of be disunited, you know, poor results in that first half, for them to end the season, you know, with survival secured, with, I think, one or two games to go, 7 points clear in the end of relegation, and to have that Portugal day on the final day of the season, you know, everyone in high spirits. I think a man dressed as some Portuguese whiskey or whatever in Club 1871. It was just really, really nice to see.
It was, and this is why I kind of feel it fields my sort of idea that he was a short-term signing, because he said all the right things for the fans. He gave an identity that people could cling on to and sort of brew online and everything. And the results were there to obviously, you're absolutely right, they were the most entertaining way of winning games. Everyone loves a last-minute winner, and it covers the cracks of what's happened in the previous 90 minutes. And it worked for that period of time. The reasons it didn't work in the following season we'll get onto, but for that 6 to 8 weeks, wherever it was, the club was on a real good high. The fans were happy. We'd won a relegation battle, and Gomez, his credit in that is by, you know, uniting the club, because we hadn't had that for a long time. But he was a man that served a purpose for that 6 to 8 week period. And ultimately, I think the way that we did win those games, while entertaining, showed, you know, the quality of opposition that we had to, you know, Blackburn, Wigan and Ipswich weren't the best teams in that division at all, and yet we had to rely on last-minute winners against them. And that is kind of what unfolded the following season.
We went into the summer, so you know, quite optimistic, really, after that. End to the campaign, you were sort of hoping for these signings, obviously the gaps left by the five loan signings who will return to their parent clubs. But really, Reading struggled to bring any players in. And I think, you know, it's very clear that the Chinese owners had the money. You know, we'll see that later in the summer. And you know, they've certainly got ambition, but obviously, you know, trying to stick to the financial fair play rules and whatnot, Reading didn't really get anyone in. And I think obviously we went off to Spain on that pre-season tour, and I think the majority of the squad was sort of made up of academy players. Xiao Virginia came in on loan again. I don't know how much money we're really paying for him. I think Everton are probably paying a large portion of his wages. Charlie Adam and Michael Morrison both came in, but again, both free agents. Obviously, you know, we're seeing in sort of the recent weeks how important they've been, but they certainly weren't exciting signings at the time. And it wasn't really sort of until that late window splurge where, you know, George Puskas came in and broke the transfer record. Lucas Shaw, I think, was about £6 million as well. Matt Miazga and Ovie Ejaria returned on loan, as did Pele and Lucas Boya also came in on loan. It was quite a weird summer, really, wasn't it, Mark? I think, you know, you sort of go through this period for so long of not really getting anyone in, and then you have this mad sort of final couple of days that, again, you know, sort of puts expectations, you know, sky high again.
Yeah, and there is a case to be made that it was that late window splurge that was the end of Gomez, because we spent much of that summer accepting that we were going to be a pretty inconsistent youth-led team this year. The players that we'd signed, I think Morrison was a good signing. We all knew what Charlie Adam was going to be like. No one got too excited by that, and that was kind of the point. And we went into that season, you know, with medium expectations, but the players we had were going to be good enough to get us, we thought, at least like a lower mid-table finish. And with players like Elise and Lola getting more game time, we come to accept that, I think, as a fan base, especially given that it was all based around money problems. Yeah. The money problem argument goes out the window when you sign two strikers for £13 million and a Serie A goalkeeper who probably has a relatively decent wage, if not a huge one. And from then on, I think it just kind of, I wouldn't say that it unsettled the team, because I disagree with the notion that, oh, Puskas needed a pre-season or Zhao needed a pre-season. Zhao's played in the Championship for years. He'd scored against us the week before, so it's not like he needed any time. Puskas, I don't know what necessarily you gain from him, you know, being in Reading for 6 more weeks compared to what he's done, because he's shown some fundamental flaws in his game that he's only been able to fix in a 5-minute burst. So all it did really was change the sort of way that I think the owners saw the season. I think that while we as fans think that mid-table is a pretty good season, if you finish 11th, I think we'd all take that at the moment. What the owners thought, having spent that money, was that we needed to be challenging for the playoffs. And they saw, I mean, that came after we had a really good week against Cardiff, West Brom and Huddersfield. 7 points out of that, absolutely perfect. Then I think there's the expectation that we're going to kick on and show that that's the real true Reading and that's who we're going to be. And it just wasn't going to happen. Gomez wasn't capable really of finding a solution for that squad. He'd set up in a 3-5-2 that we worked, but was going to eventually, as we all pretty much feared at the time, was going to get worked out. And it did. And the players that we'd signed, those like Zhao and Puskas, just can't play together. The strikers that we had were all too similar. And it's almost no surprise, really, with a manager at the level of Gomez, someone who, like Stam, suffered from a lack of plan B, like all his predecessors, just suffered from that, I suppose, inability to just rally the troops at key moments. And I suppose probably the problem amongst that was that we were suffering really demoralising defeats. We weren't losing. You know, we lost 1-0 at Middlesbrough. That was probably the tightest defeat we had. But we had loads of chances. And that's a demoralising defeat because we had loads of chances. Losing at home to Charlton, losing home to Blackburn, getting spanked 4-1 by Fulham. All of these games at home, they're demoralising defeats. And Gomez just wasn't able to pick the squad up from that. He didn't have the assets in the squad to change it round. And even what he did have, he wasn't willing to change too much. And we fell behind in pretty much all of those games. It was crying out for something to happen. And I think given the fact that the owners spent so much money, it was no surprise that they genuinely thought we were a playoff team and therefore they had to sack him.
I mean, there were reports, of course, that Gomez had sort of lost the dressing room as well. I think, you know, a car salesman was, you know, one alleged name that they'd given him. I think for me, that's almost when you get to the point of no return, if that is true, that once you've lost that dressing room, it becomes very, very difficult to win it back. And as you say, 5 defeats in 6 games followed that week where we got 7 points from 9 against Cardiff, West Brom and Huddersfield. 5 defeats in 6 games followed that, including that 4-1 defeat at home to Fulham where John Swift gets sent off very early on and Reading just really struggled to, you know, match the sides who are, you know, obviously in the Premier League last season and full of a lot more quality. And Gomez is sacked then in October with Reading 22nd in the table. And the second worst win percentage in the modern era. Of course, Paul Clement holding the fateful record of having the worst win percentage. How do we look back on that sacking then, Mark, you know, sort of 2 months on? Because, as you know, we did our podcast at the time when he was sacked. And I think the general feeling, I think it was very split from Reading fans. And we'll come on to the appointment of Mark Byrne in just a minute. But, you know, sort of in hindsight, maybe in 2 months on, does it seem as though that probably was the right time for a change?
I think if you look at it from this, you know, point of view, 2 months on, I think you look at the results, and I've had the Wikipedia pages up for all of the seasons that we've been discussing, and the period since Bowen has come in charge has had by far the most blocks of green in terms of how many games we've won of any of them, and you can see, it's actually quite impressive, really, especially our home form, the way that we've, you know, obviously just had 2 wins against Derby and QPR, beat Millwall and Luton. Those were not the games we were winning before. We would lose at least 2 of those games. We'd probably draw another one of them because we weren't very good at home against, you know, the lesser sides or whatever you want to call them. How we look upon the Gomez sacking in two, you know, let's say at the end of the season, I think we'll probably look on it as a good thing, presuming that Bowen at least keeps to some degree of this success and keeps us safe, etc. Some fans will always think that Gomez will have been able to do the same thing. There is very little evidence for that based on his results for the, you know, the previous few weeks before he got sacked. And the type of wins we're getting are based on a new-ish philosophy. It's not a completely new philosophy, but there has been a hell of a lot more pragmatism, a lot more flexibility. And ultimately, I think those are the things that we're getting that we're rewarded for. To look upon it at the end of next season as it was at the right sacking, I don't think necessarily that more time was going to help Gomez. It's the same with Stam. The idea that you don't sack him on the basis that, oh, he'll be good in 12 months, he'll be good in 18 months. I don't think it really holds as a good theory for these guys because you don't just become a good team overnight. You have to build to something. You have to have a plan and a squad that's capable of doing it. And, you know, it grows inside the club.
I don't think what Gomez was going for was necessarily going to work with this set of players. Obviously, when you've got Ajari and Swift on good form, whatever you do is going to work to some extent. But with the strikers that we'd signed, with the players over the last 4 or 5 years that we have been signing generally, I'm just not sure that Gomez had it in him to get this squad. Yes, he would have kept it safe, I think, this season. But did he have the creativity as a manager, the flexibility that you need, the overall vision to get us to the playoffs? I just can't see it. And Bowen, you know, I can only see it to an extent with him. Whether he stays beyond the season, who knows? But for Gomez, I just can't see a scenario where he would have taken us from being a team that can survive to a team that can challenge for the playoffs. And ultimately, that, you know, even as fans with our expectations now, in the next 2-3 years, that has to be the goal. And therefore, I think that his just general quality as a manager shows that it probably was, you know, as sad as it is to say, for a nice man, you know, I've met him a couple of times and he always came across very well. But as a manager, I don't think he had it enough to cut it at the top of the championship.
I do tend to agree, and I think you can be thankful for Gomez for last season. As I say, I think, you know, the transformation that occurred under him, and I think he made watching Reading fun again. And I think you can be thankful for that, you know, to a certain extent. And he kept us up, you know, quite comfortably in the end. But yeah, I think just the way we were playing this season, I think, you know, you could talk about small margins and the sort of likes of George Puskas missing chances, and if he put a couple of his shots away, would Gomez still be here? And I think it is quite possible that he could be, but at the end of the day, I think Gomez was limited to an extent and he couldn't quite get the best out of this side. Obviously, you know, he's clearly a very, as we say, a very popular guy, very nice guy. He's already back in football, back in Portugal. I think Manitoba is taken over there, you know, so he's clearly, you know, a very likable guy. But I think in terms of where he'd taken Reading to, and I think, as you say, with the money that we spent in the summer, the owners expected an awful lot more. And, you know, they certainly weren't going to be happy with, you know, a third straight season battling down at the bottom. We come on now then finally to where we are now. Mark Bowen, very early days, 2 months into his tenure, and a hugely controversial appointment. I think it won our comedy moment of 2019 in the podcast awards. And I have never seen a reaction like it when Mark Bowen was appointed as Reading manager. Of course, he came in as technical consultant towards the end of last season, moved into the technical director role in the summer, and now has, you know, completed the transformation and become manager. But the reaction on social media, obviously, is, you know, I think Twitter is very much a bubble, and it's you can't, you know, take everything from Twitter. But the reaction to Mark Burns' appointment, you know, the whole snake thing, he appointed himself. I've never seen anything quite like it. But in fact, I think he's done, you know, considering all of that and sort of the reaction that he came into, he's done a very, very good job. And as I say, we're still, you know, only 2 months into his tenure, still very early days. But I think he's probably being a little bit unfairly judged based on that arrival, because actually he's taken Reading away from the relegation zone. I think we're now, you know, about 8 points clear of the bottom three. And I think based on results since his arrival, I think Reading would be about fourth or fifth in the table, which isn't too bad at all. And I think over the course of the season, I think his points per game, if that was replicated over 46 games, we'd have about, you know, 70-odd points, which, again, is almost enough sort of to be challenging for those playoff positions, especially at home. We've had a very, very good record. You know, we beat Preston, we beat Mill, Luton, Derby, all at home. And I think we've lost two home games, I think against Leeds and Birmingham. But other than that, I think for someone who I wasn't too sure about when he came in, obviously this is his first managerial job, so largely being number two under Mark Hughes for much of his career. I mean, you know, we spoke about Paul Clement, obviously more used to being a number two, and he couldn't quite crack it as a number one at Reading. But for me, the first 2 months of the Mark Bowen era have been a lot better than I thought they probably would have been.
I would have to agree with that. I think it was unprecedented, wasn't it, the way that he came into the job. Yeah. I don't think I can name any other English football scenario where that has happened. And quite frankly, we all know that if we'd read about it happening in Italy or a league like that, we'd all be saying the exact same thing, and we'd all be saying it's a joke and a shambles and everything. Luckily, we have a little bit more insight on Reading, and we can probably say that it wasn't him who sacked Gomez, and it wasn't him who then hired himself as the replacement, which is, a you know, obviously a good thing that that didn't happen. But yeah, I think the reaction that he showed to that, because obviously it was what we were all talking about. Did he do Gomez to let himself in through the door? And the reaction was so big to that, and his response to that was very telling, because his response was very clearly, nope, didn't happen, nothing to worry about, move on. And he didn't spend, I think in his press conference, that I can't even think of much more than a sentence that he gave to that. And therefore, that's a sign that he doesn't actually really care what people think. And he's, you know, he's from the Mark Hughes School of Football. So it's not too surprising that he doesn't spend too much time. You know, he probably doesn't go much on Twitter and everything like that. And that's, you know, probably for the better. And what we've also seen is that translates into his way of being a manager. He is unashamed in going to Stoke and getting a point without having a shot on target. He is unashamed about, you know, squeezing a point out of Barnsley, because he knows that these aren't games you can take for granted. No matter where a team is in the Championship, you almost have to treat it like they're playoffs, even if they're in the relegation zone, because that's a sort of inconsistent quality. And if Stoke or Barnsley play terrible, we get a win, then great. But obviously, if we're not playing great, they're not playing great. He doesn't mind taking a point from that game. He doesn't look over to the away fans and think, oh God, they're a bit bored. He sees the bigger picture. And he knows that we've got Derby at home the week after, get 3 points there. That's, you know, we picked up, was it 8 points out of our last four games?
Yeah.
That's a very, very good tally. For every four games you pick up 8 points, you'll get promoted with that. So his benefit as a manager is the fact that he is very confident in himself. He doesn't, which I don't think Paul Clement was. He isn't afraid to change things, which I think Gomez and Stam were. And, you know, I think as we go through this season, I think we'll see someone who probably, you know, if he doesn't get the job at the end of the year and we find someone better for whatever reason, I think he'll probably take that with a bit of humility, because he does seem to be that man who says, you know what, this is an opportunity. He'll do the best he does. If he doesn't work out, then so be it. Because I don't think he walks into the, maybe Paul Clement and maybe to an extent Gomez and Stam did this, I don't think he walks into Reading every day thinking, this is my time, this is the moment to, you know, etch my name into the annals of history. I think he just walks in there and thinks, let's do the job, let's get what we can do, get the best out of the players, and then see what happens. And I think that's probably just about the right thing we need at the moment.
It's back to basics in a sense, and I think it's never going to be the most entertaining football to watch. And I think, you know, that's, you know, perhaps what some fans are a little bit annoyed about in his first few months, that we're not playing the most attractive for football. It's quite long ball. But at the end of the day, it's getting results. And as I say, you know, he got 10 points from his first 12 games as manager, which I think is one of the best records in about 40 or 50 years. He's got 8 points from the last 12. We'd be fourth or fifth in the table if the season had started when he took over. And, you know, quite frankly, it's very difficult debate that we had when we talked about Stan with Sim, and we can't get too much into it now. But it's a case of, you know, what would you prefer, entertaining football or results? And I think after the last couple of seasons that we've had, I would take results every single day of the week. And I think the fact that we're just winning games again, sort of, you know, winning two games in a row, we just happened so rarely the last few years. We've always got to win and then be let down the next week by drawing or losing. But to have these runs of sort of two wins in a row that we've had twice now under Bowen, it sounds silly, but it's just been really sort of uplifting. And, you know, I think if we can get more wins than losses in 2020, I would 100% take that, you know, after the last couple of years that we've had. But that does round off then this episode of the Decade in Review, and indeed the whole decade. We have got one episode left in your podcast feeds tomorrow that will be looking back sort of at the whole decade as a whole, looking at sort of the key players, our team in the decade that we've released over on the Tile House, and some key moments, and also looking ahead to the new decade and what is to come for Reading in the 2020s. Where will we be in 10 years' time and whatnot? Obviously, you know, it's been a 10 years full of ups and downs, Reading, you know, in fact, really. I think in a better league position now than they were 10 years ago. But to say that is a discussion for our final episode, part four of the Decade in Review tomorrow. But other than that, thank you very much, Mark, for joining me on this part three of the Decade in Review.
Thank you very much, mate. And as I'm not on the Next Decade Preview podcast, I will just quickly give my two cents. I think that football hasn't changed very much over the last decade, but I think it could change a hell of a lot in the decades to come. And I think that is probably the sort of thing that might well benefit Reading.
Yeah, it is. It's certainly exciting. I think, you know, we've seen, you know, like some VAR introduced in the last couple of years, goal line technology. So who knows? We might have robot refs or whatever in the next 10 years. But as I say, yeah, keep an eye out on your podcast feeds for that one tomorrow. As I say, plenty of content as well in terms of the decade over on the tilehouseden.com. As I say, our team of the decade was announced throughout December, and the full 11 was announced on Christmas Day. So do go and check that out. We've also got our moments of the decade as well, still going up as well. And you can contribute to that yourself if you want to. Please get in touch. TileHeadsEnd@gmail.com is the email, or DM us on Twitter if you want to write about your memorable moment from the 2010s. Other than that, as I say, keep an eye on your podcast feeds tomorrow. But thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Decade in Review. And come on, you Ars.
Keep up to date with all things Reading FC. Follow the Tilehurst End on Facebook and Twitter.